The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi everybody, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. The author O. Henry was born in Greensboro, North Carolina, 160 years ago in 1862. And to celebrate his birth, I'll read today an article about O. Henry from the New Yorker magazine, and then I'll read one of his short stories. From the book section of the July 5th, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, are all short stories O. Henry stories? The writer's signature style of ending a final thrilling note has the touch of magic that distinguishes the form at its best. By Louis Menand. The story of the writer who called himself O. Henry could almost be an O. Henry story. The writer, his real name was William Sidney Porter, had a secret, and he spent most of his adult life trying to conceal it. The pseudonym was part of that effort, but Porter also avoided being photographed, rarely gave interviews, and steered clear of situations where someone might pry into his past. He was not a recluse, but he did not like to be the center of attention. People found him affable, unpretentious, and somewhat inscrutable. As a writer, Porter was identified with New York City, where more than 100 of his stories are set. But he was born in the Confederacy in Greensboro, North Carolina, in 1862. And he retained, as you can see in some of his stories, the racial prejudices of a white Southerner of his time. His early life was unsettled. At 19, he was licensed as a pharmacist, his uncle's occupation, and his stories have occasional references to drugs and medications, many of which can look fictional to a layperson but are apparently accurate. Soon afterward, he moved to Texas and worked on a ranch, although he spent much of his time there reading. He later published a number of stories set in the West. He met his future wife in Austin. It seems to have been love at first sight, something that happens more than once in O. Henry stories. And he began a lifelong practice of roaming the streets, hanging out in bars. He was a prodigious drinker with a reputation for being able to handle his liquor, and observing life after dark. He liked to listen to people talk about themselves, and he used their stories as the basis for his fiction. Porter was also a talented cartoonist and composed humorous verses, and he started up a weekly called The Rolling Stone as an outlet for his work. It did not prove to be a financially sustainable proposition. And then disaster struck. After Porter and his wife had a daughter, he took a job as a teller in the First National Bank of Austin. In 1894, a federal bank examiner discovered a shortage of $5,654 in the First National Bank's accounts and accused Porter of embezzlement. It was natural to assume that Porter had borrowed money from the till to keep his struggling magazine out of debt, intending to pay it back. And that may be true, but what really happened is unclear. The shortfall could have been a matter of sloppy bookkeeping, or it could be that others were in on the pilfering. On the few occasions that Porter is reported to have alluded to the episode, he implied that he was covering for someone else, but he never said who it was. The bank was happy to settle, and a grand jury refused to issue an indictment. But the federal examiner was zealous. A second grand jury was convened, and this time Porter was indicted. Just before his trial was scheduled to start in the summer of 1896, he fled to Honduras, leaving his wife and his six-year-old daughter behind. Honduras was an attractive haven for people in Porter's situation, because it did not have an extradition treaty with the United States. Porter later wrote several linked stories set in a banana republic, a term he seems to have coined. But when he learned that his wife was ill, he returned to be with her and to stand trial. She died of tuberculosis in 1897 at the age of 29. He declined to speak in his own defense and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. And that is the secret he spent the rest of his life trying to hide, even from his daughter. In an O. Henry story, the secret would be the climactic reveal. In prison, Porter wrote 14 stories and began using O. Henry as a pen name. He had other aliases, but after 1903, he signed everything O. Henry. He was released with time off for good behavior in 1901 and moved first to Pittsburgh, where his daughter was living, and then in 1902 to New York City, a place he had never visited, but where his prospects as a writer were better because he would be closer to his editors. In New York, he began producing at an astonishing rate. He contracted to write a story a week for the Sunday World, and he continued to write for magazines. In 1904 alone, he published 66 stories. He began bringing out collections, notably in 1906, The 4 Million, which contained some of his most famous work, The Gift of the Magi, The Cop and the Anthem, An Unfinished Story, and The Furnished Room. Porter's daughter remained in Pittsburgh, and although he wrote to her regularly and affectionately, they rarely saw each other. His lifestyle made living with a dependent impossible. He kept irregular hours, and his biographer, Richard O'Connor, says that he was a womanizer. As Porter had done since his Austin days, he spent his evenings talking to people he met in restaurants and bars. Financially, he led the hand-to-mouth existence of most full-time writers, even very successful ones. You can't live off pieces you've already been paid for. You always have to be producing a new piece, and you're always afraid that it won't be as good as your last piece. Despite his rate of production, Porter found writing stressful and had trouble with deadlines. And he was frank about the fact that he wrote for the income. When he started getting paid more for his stories, he wrote fewer of them. Not that he saved up the money. He was never prudent. He gave a lot away, and there is some evidence that he was blackmailed by a woman who knew his secret. Even after he had become famous and his work was in constant demand, he was perpetually pleading with his editors to advance him funds against his next story. He received no royalties from a hit Broadway play based on a character in one of his stories, Jimmy Valentine. A series of popular Hollywood movies were based on another character he had created, the Cisco Kid, but they were made after he died. He tried his hand at a musical, and he contracted to write a novel, but those projects went nowhere. He was a short story writer. That was what he was good at. In 1907, he married a woman he had known from his childhood in Greensboro, but his health had been deteriorating, largely because of the drinking. Suffering from cirrhosis of the liver, diabetes, and a dilated heart, he died in 1910. He was 47. He was begging his editor for a fresh advance right up to the end. Ben Yagoda, the editor of the new Library of America volume O. Henry, 101 Stories, says that Porter published hundreds of short stories, along with ephemera that appeared in the Rolling Stone and the Houston Post, where he worked as a reporter during some of his Texas years. The best way to consider the stories as an oeuvre, I think, is on the model of the comic strip, which is effectively what they were when they appeared once a week in the Sunday World. In some weeks, your favorite comic strip is more entertaining than it is in others. But you always read it because you know what you're going to get. The same is true of O. Henry stories. Porter had a formula, he had a set of character types, and he had a distinctive verbal palette. The palette is what the critic H. L. Mencken, who disliked O. Henry's writing, called ornate Broadwayese, a style that is part Damon Runyon, the writer whose stories are the basis for the musical Guys and Dolls, and part S.J. Perelman, streetwise observations delivered in a comically overcooked or circumlocutionary manner. So you get this kind of thing. In a description of the scene around a murdered man, O. Henry wrote, "A doctor was testing him for the immortal ingredient. His decision was that it was conspicuous by its absence." Or this, about a grifter who makes his living selling bogus products and then skipping town. "He is an incorporated, uncapitalized, unlimited asylum for the reception of the restless and unwise dollars of his fellow men." O. Henry's characters, from whatever walk of life, often talk in this mode of high facetiousness, as in this case. "The feminine nature and similitude," says I, "is as plain to my sight as the Rocky Mountains is to a blue-eyed burro. I'm on to all their little sidesteps and punctual discrepancies. I never exactly heard sour milk dropping out of a balloon on the bottom of a tin pan, but I have an idea it would be music of the spheres compared to this attenuated stream of asphyxiated thought that emanates out of your organs of conversation." And Porter liked arcane words like vespertine and mucilaginous, and malapropisms like these. He wants his name, maybe, to go thundering down the corridors of time. "I follows, like Delilah, when she set the Philip Steins onto Samson." This style belongs to a comic tradition that includes George Harriman's strip Crazy Cat, which started appearing in the New York Evening Journal in 1913, and later on the movies of W.C. Fields. There is a lot of it in Dickens, Mr. Micawber, for instance, whom Porter idolized. O. Henry's readers must have found it droll. Still, a little goes a long way. The plot of nearly all the good stories in the world is concerned with shorts who are unable to cover, Porter wrote in one of his best-known works, The Third Ingredient, and the remark is in many ways the key to his writing, for he was himself such a person. Whether he filched from the First National Bank of Austin or took the fall to protect others, he had once made a bet that he could not cover. The characters in O. Henry's stories usually find themselves in similar predicaments. The woman in The Third Ingredient lacks an onion for her stew and the means to purchase one. In The Gift of the Magi, which must be the most widely anthologized O. Henry story, an impecunious young husband sells his gold watch in order to buy an expensive set of combs as a Christmas gift for his wife, only to find that she has cut off and sold her beautiful hair in order to buy him a fob chain for his watch. That story has an easy moral. It's the thought that counts, as do all the stories Porter published. Virtue in O. Henry's world is generally rewarded. And virtue is found mainly among ordinary people, particularly working women, for whom Porter had a soft spot, and people who live outside the law, like small-time crooks, tramps, and other types keen to avoid the attention of the cops. For O. Henry, it's the men in suits, the bankers, millionaires, and politicians who are the true grifters, pretending not to be the exploiters of working men and women that they truly are. His heart is with the marginalized and the downtrodden. Porter believed that their lives had a genuine human interest, and as a short story writer, he is on their side. His own money troubles stemmed in part from his generosity to people he met who were short of funds. And, as successful as he became, he always chose to identify with them. The title of the collection, The 4 Million, alludes to a list of 400 socially prominent residents of the city, which have been published in the New York Times. 4 million was the city's population at the time. Those were O. Henry's subjects. They provided his stock of character types. The common man spirit of the stories may explain their appeal to readers of the popular press in the period during which Porter was writing, a time of mass immigration to cities like New York. It may also account for the fact that he was a favorite writer of both William James, the pragmatist philosopher who hated corporate bigness, and John Reed, the American journalist who joined the Bolshevik Revolution. It surely accounts for his popularity in the Kremlin. O'Connor says that between 1920 and 1945, 1.4 million copies of the writer's books were published in the Soviet Union. Even in 1953, the final year of Stalin's dictatorship, the Soviets printed almost 250,000 O. Henry books. The thing that doubtless even Russian readers really enjoyed in an O. Henry story, though, was not the proletarian heroes, but the punchline, the twist, the reveal, what became known as the O. Henry ending. The twist, usually a neat pirouette at the very end, annoyed critics like Mencken, who complained about O. Henry's variety show smartness. And there is something gimmicky about the endings. But Porter, although he pretended to regard himself as a hack, was well-read and a self-conscious writer. He understood the literary form he was working in. Porter was writing in a golden age for the short story, which starts with Edgar Allan Poe and includes Anton Chekhov, Guy de Maupassant, and Charles Chestnut. He was a contemporary of two wildly popular story writers, Arthur Conan Doyle, 1859 to 1930, and Rudyard Kipling, 1865 to 1936, and his own work can be classed with the subgenres they worked in, the detective story and the ghost story, both of which are gimmicky in the sense that they are deliberately crafted to startle and surprise. You know what you're getting when you read a Sherlock Holmes story. The near contemporary, whose work most resembles Porter's, is the Scottish writer H.H. Munro, born 1870, died 1816, also universally known by a pen name, Saki. Munro's characters are drawn from the upper classes, and his prose is droll in the British way, wry and epigrammatic. He is a much defter comic writer than Porter, but he also specialized in short stories, some, like the classic The Open Window, very short, with surprise endings. If you think about the experience of reading a short story, you can feel, even in the case of stories by literary writers like Chekhov or Hemingway, that the ending is the money note of the form, the high C of the composition. And the pleasure it gives us is, in some way, sensory. It produces a brief thrill, a frisson, sometimes, as with many Kipling stories, a sense of mystery. What really happened? Sometimes, as with ghost stories, a little shiver of horror. Sometimes, as with detective stories, a satisfying aha. Edgar Allan Poe, who wrote both detective stories and ghost stories, called this sensation the effect. And he thought that producing it was the purpose of all short-form writing, including poetry. A skillful literary artist has constructed a tale, he wrote in 1842. If wise, he has not fashioned his thoughts to accommodate his incidents, but having conceived, with deliberate care, a certain unique or single effect to be wrought out, he then invents such incidents as may best aid him in establishing this preconceived effect. Short stories are more like poems than like novels. Novelists put stuff in because they are trying to represent a world. Story writers, as Poe implied, leave stuff out. They are not trying to represent a world. They are trying to express a single intangible thing. The story writer begins with an idea about what readers will feel when they finish reading, just as a lyric poet starts with a nonverbal state of mind and then constructs a verbal artifact that evokes it. The endings of modern short stories tend to be oblique, but they, too, are structured for an effect, frequently of pathos. Porter was perfectly aware that he was a writer of popular confections. He continually downplayed the literary merits of his work, saying that he couldn't understand why anyone would take it seriously, but these are indications that he had higher aspirations as a writer. His last story idea was for The Cosmopolitan, titled The Dream. It was about a man who has gone down the wrong road, who dreamed the wrong dream. Porter intended the story to be different from his customary product. "I want to show the public," he explained, "that I can write something new, New for me, I mean. A story without slang, a straightforward dramatic plot treated in a way that will come nearer my idea of real story writing. We don't know how that turned out, because the story, like the career, was unfinished. And now I'll read that short story by O. Henry, in which he invents the character the Cisco Kid. The Caballero's Way, by O. Henry. The Cisco Kid had killed 6 men in more or less fair scrimmages, had murdered twice as many, mostly Mexicans, and had winged a larger number whom he modestly forbore to count. Therefore, a woman loved him. The kid was 25, looked 20, and a careful insurance company would have estimated the probable time of his demise at, say, 26. His habitat was anywhere between the Frio and the Rio Grande. He killed for the love of it, because he was quick-tempered to avoid arrest. For his own amusement, any reason that came to his mind would suffice. He had escaped capture because he could shoot 5/6 of a second sooner than any sheriff or ranger in the service, and because he rode a speckled roan horse that knew every cow path in the mesquite and pear thickets from San Antonio to Matamoros. Doña Perez, the girl who loved Cisco Kid, was half Carmen, half Madonna, and the rest. Oh, yes, a woman who is half Carmen and half Madonna can always be something more. The rest, let us say, was Hummingbird. She lived in a grass-roofed jacal near a little Mexican settlement at the Lone Wolf Crossing of the Frio. With her lived a father or grandfather, a lineal Aztec, somewhat less than 1,000 years old, who herded 100 goats and lived in a continuous drunken dream from drinking mezcal. Back of the jackal, a tremendous forest of bristling pear, 20 feet high at its worst, crowded almost to its door. It was along the bewildering maze of this spinous thicket that the speckled roan would bring the kid to see his girl. And once, clinging like a lizard to the ridgepole, high up under the peaked grass roof, he had heard Tanya, with her Madonna face and Carmen beauty and Hummingbird soul, parley with the sheriff's posse, denying knowledge of her man in her soft melange of Spanish and English. One day, the adjutant general of the state, who is ex officio commander of the ranger forces, wrote some sarcastic lines to Captain Duval of Company X, stationed at Laredo, relative to the serene and undisturbed existence led by murderers and desperados in the said captain's territory. The captain turned the color of brick dust under his tan and forwarded the letter, after adding a few comments, per Ranger Private Bill Adamson, to Ranger Lieutenant Sandridge, camped at a water hole on the Nueces with a squad of 5 men in preservation of law and order. Lieutenant Sandridge turned a beautiful couleur de rose through his ordinary strawberry complexion, tucked the letter in his hip pocket, and chewed off the ends of his gambogue mustache. The next morning, he saddled his horse and rode alone to the Mexican settlement at the Lone Wolf Crossing of the Frio, 20 miles away. 6'2", blonde as a Viking, quiet as a deacon, dangerous as a machine gun, Sandridge moved among the jacales, patiently seeking news of the Cisco Kid. Far more than the law, the Mexicans dreaded the cold and certain vengeance of the lone rider that the ranger sought. It had been one of the kid's pastimes to shoot Mexicans, to see them kick. If he demanded from them moribund terpescorian feats, simply that he might be entertained, what terrible and extreme penalties would be certain to follow should they anger him? One and all, they lounged with upturned palms and shrugging shoulders, filling the air with quien sabes and denials of the kid's acquaintance. But there was a man named Fink who kept a store at the crossing, a man of many nationalities, tongues, interests, and ways of thinking. "No use to ask them Mexicans," he said to Sandridge. "They're afraid to tell. This hombre they call the Kid, Goodall's his name, ain't it? He's been in my store once or twice. I have an idea you might run across him at... but I guess I don't care to say myself. I'm 2 seconds later in pulling a gun than I used to be, and that difference is worth thinking about. But this Kid's got a half-Mexican girl at the crossing that he comes to see. She lives in that Chacala 100 yards down the arroyo at the edge of the pear. Maybe she... No, I don't suppose she would, but that jackal would be a good place to watch anyway." Sandridge rode down to the Jackal of Perez. The sun was low, and the broad shade of the great pear thicket already covered the grass-thatched hut. The goats were enclosed for the night in a brush corral nearby. A few kids walked the top of it, nibbling the chaparral leaves. The old Mexican lay upon a blanket on the grass, already in a stupor from his mezcal, and dreaming, perhaps, of the nights when he and Pizarro touched glasses to their new world fortunes. So old his wrinkled face seemed to proclaim him to be. And in the door of the Jackal stood Tonya. And Lieutenant Sandridge sat in his saddle staring at her like a gannet agape at a sailorman. The Cisco Kid was a vain person, as all eminent and successful assassins are. And his bosom would have been ruffled had he known that at a simple exchange of glances, two persons in whose minds he had been looming large suddenly abandoned, at least for the time, all thought of him. Never before had Tonya seen such a man as this. He seemed to be made of sunshine and blood-red tissue and clear weather. He seemed to illuminate the shadow of the pear when he smiled, as though the sun were rising again. The men she had known had been small and dark. Even the Kid, in spite of his achievements, was a stripling no larger than herself, with black, straight hair and a cold, marble face that chilled the noonday. As for Tonya, although she sends description to the poorhouse, let her make a millionaire of your fancy. Her blue-black hair, smoothly divided in the middle and bound close to her head, and her large eyes, full of the Latin melancholy, gave her the Madonna touch. Her motions and air spoke of the concealed fire and the desire to charm that she had inherited from the Gitanas of the Basque province. As for the hummingbird part of her, that dwelt in her heart. You could not perceive it unless her bright red skirt and dark blue blouse gave you a symbolic hint of the vagarious bird. The newly lighted sun god asked for a drink of water. Tonya brought it from the red jar hanging under the brush shelter. Sandridge considered it necessary to dismount so as to lessen the trouble of her ministrations. I play no spy, nor do I assume to master the thoughts of any human heart. But I assert by the chronicler's right that before a quarter of an hour had sped, Sandridge was teaching her how to plank a 6-strand rawhide stake rope. And Tonya had explained to him that were it not for her little English book that the peripatetic padre had given her and the crippled little chivo that she fed from a bottle, she would be very, very lonely indeed. Which leads to the suspicion that the Kid's fences needed repairing, and that the adjutant general's sarcasm had fallen upon unproductive soil. In his camp by the waterhole, Lieutenant Sandridge announced and reiterated his intention of either causing the Cisco Kid to nibble the black loam of the Frio country prairies, or of hauling him before a judge and jury. That sounded businesslike. Twice a week he rode over to the Lone Wolf crossing of the Frio and directed Tonya's slim, slightly lemon-tinted fingers among the intricacies of the slowly growing lariata. A 6-strand plait is hard to learn and easy to teach. The ranger knew that he might find the kid there at any visit. He kept his armament ready and had a frequent eye for the pear thicket at the rear of the jacal. Thus, he might bring down the kite and the hummingbird with one stone. While the sunny-haired ornithologist was pursuing his studies, the Cisco kid was also attending to his professional duties. He moodily shot up a saloon in a small cow village on Quintana Creek, killed the town marshal, plugging him neatly in the center of his tin badge, and then rode away, morose and unsatisfied. No true artist is uplifted by shooting an aged man carrying an old-style .38 bulldog. On his way, the kid suddenly experienced the yearning that all men feel when wrongdoing loses its keen edge of delight. He yearned for the woman he loved, to reassure him that she was his in spite of it. He wanted her to call his bloodthirstiness bravery and his cruelty devotion. He wanted Tanya to bring him water from the red jar under the brush shelter and tell him how the chivo was thriving on the bottle. The kid turned the speckled roan's head up the 10-mile pear flat that stretches along the Arroyo Hondo until it ends at the Lone Wolf crossing of the Frio. The roan wickered, for he had a sense of locality and direction equal to that of a beltline streetcar horse, and he knew he would soon be nibbling the rich mesquite grass at the end of a 40-foot stake rope while Ulysses rested his head in Circe's straw-roofed hut. More weird and lonesome than the journey of an Amazonian explorer is the ride of one through a Texas pear flat. With dismal monotony and startling variety, the uncanny and multiform shapes of the cacti lift their twisted trunks and fat, bristly hands to encumber the way. The demon plant, appearing to live without soil or rain, seems to taunt the parched traveler with its lush gray greenness. It warps itself a thousand times about what looked to be open and inviting paths, only to lure the rider into blind and impassable spine-defended bottoms of the bag, leaving him to retreat, if he can, with the points of the compass whirling in his head. To be lost in the pear is to die almost the death of the thief on the cross, pierced by nails and with grotesque shapes of all the fiends hovering about. But it was not so with the kid and his mount. Winding, twisting, circling, tracing the most fantastic and bewildering trail ever picked out, the good roan lessened the distance to the Lone Wolf crossing with every coil and turn that he made. While they fared, the kid sang. He knew but one tune and sang it, as he knew but one code and lived it, and but one girl and loved her. He was a single-minded man of conventional ideas. He had a voice like a coyote with bronchitis. But whenever he chose to sing his song, he sang it. It was a conventional song of the camps and trail, running at its beginning as near as may be to these words. Don't you monkey with my Lulu girl, or I'll tell you what I'll do, and so on. The roan was inured to it and did not mind. But even the poorest singer will, after a certain time, gain his own consent to refrain from contributing to the world's noises. So the kid, by the time he was within a mile or two of Tonya's jackal, had reluctantly allowed his song to die away. Not because his vocal performance had become less charming to his own ears, but because his laryngeal muscles were aweary. As though he were in a circus ring, the speckled roan wheeled and danced through the labyrinth of pear until at length his rider knew, by certain landmarks, that the Lone Wolf crossing was close at hand. Then, where the pear was thinner, he caught sight of the grass roof of the jacal and the hackberry tree on the edge of the arroyo. A few yards later, the kid stopped the roan and gazed intently through the prickly openings. Then he dismounted, dropped the roan's reins, and proceeded on foot, stooping and silent, like an Indian. The roan, knowing his part, stood still, making no sound. The kid crept noiselessly to the very edge of the pear thicket and reconnoitered between the leaves of a clump of cactus. 10 yards from his hiding place, in the shade of the jacal, sat his Tonya, calmly plaiting a rawhide lariat. So far she might surely escape condemnation. Women have been known, from time to time, to engage in more mischievous occupations. But if all must be told, there is to be added that her head reposed against the broad and comfortable chest of a tall red and yellow man, and that his arm was about her, guiding her nimble fingers that required so many lessons at the intricate six-strand plait. Sandridge glanced quickly at the dark mass of pear when he heard a slight squeaking sound that was not altogether unfamiliar. A gun scabbard will make that sound when one grasps the handle of a six-shooter suddenly. But the sound was not repeated, and Tonya's fingers needed close attention. And then, in the shadow of death, they began to talk of their love. And in the still July afternoon, every word that they uttered reached the ears of the kid.
"Remember then," said Tonya, "you must not come again until I send for you. Soon he will be here. A vaquero at the tienda said today he saw him on the Guadalupe 3 days ago. When he is that near, he always comes. If he comes and finds you here, he will kill you. So, for my sake, you must come no more until I send you the word."
"All right," said the stranger. "And then what?"
"And then," said the girl, "you must bring your men here and kill him. If not, he will kill you."
"Well, he ain't a man to surrender, that's sure," said Sandridge. "It's kill or be killed for that officer that goes up against Mr. Cisco Kid."
"He must die," said the girl. "Otherwise, there will not be any peace in the world for thee and me. He has killed many. Let him so die. Bring your men and give him no chance to escape."
"He used to think right much of him," said Sandridge. Tonya dropped the lariat, twisted herself around, and curved a lemon-tinted arm over the ranger's shoulder.
"But then," she murmured in liquid Spanish, "I had not beheld thee, thou great red mountain of a man. And thou art kind and good, as well as strong. Could one choose him, knowing thee? Let him die. For then I will not be filled with fear by day and night, lest he hurt thee or me."
"How can I know when he comes?" asked Sandridge.
"When he comes," said Tonya, "he remains 2 days, sometimes three. Gregorio, the son of old Luisa, the lavandera, has a swift pony. I will write a letter to thee and send it by him, saying how it will be best to come upon him. By Gregorio will the letter come, and bring many men with thee, and have much care, O dear one, for the rattlesnake is not quicker to strike than is El Chifato, as they call him, to send a ball from his pistola."
"The kid's handy with his gun, sure enough," admitted Sandridge. "But when I come for him, I shall come alone. I'll get him myself, or not at all. The cap wrote one or two things to me that make me want to do the trick without any help. You let me know when Mr. Kidd arrives, and I'll do the rest."
"I will send you the message by the boy Gregorio," said the girl. "I knew you were braver than that small slayer of men who never smiles. How could I ever have thought I cared for him?"
It was time for the ranger to ride back to his camp on the waterhole. Before he mounted his horse, he raised the slight form of Tonya with one arm high from the earth,
for a parting salute. The drowsy stillness of the torpid summer air still lay thick upon the dreaming afternoon. The smoke from the fire in the jacal where the frijoles blubbered in the iron pot rose straight as a plumb line above the clay-daubed chimney. No sound or movement disturbed the serenity of the dense pear thicket 10 yards away, when the form of Sandridge had disappeared. Loping his big dun down the steep banks of the Frio crossing, the kid crept back to his own horse, mounted him, and rode back along the torturous trail he had come. But not far. He stopped and waited in the silent depths of the pear until half an hour had passed. And then Tanya heard the high, untrue notes of his unmusical singing coming nearer and nearer, and she ran to the edge of the pear to meet him. The kid seldom smiled, but he smiled and waved his hat when he saw her. He dismounted, and his girl sprang into his arms. The kid looked at her fondly. His thick black hair clung to his head like a wrinkled mat. The meeting brought a slight ripple of some undercurrent of feeling to his smooth, dark face that was usually as motionless as a clay mask. "How's my girl?" he asked, holding her close.
"Sick of waiting so long for you, dear one," she answered. "My eyes are dim with always gazing into that devil's pincushion through which you come. And I can see into it such a little way, too. But you are here, beloved one, and I will not scold. Que mal muchacho not to come to see your alma more often. Go in and rest, and let me water your horse and stake him with the long rope. There is cool water in the jar for you."
The kid kissed her affectionately. "Not if the court knows itself do I let a lady stake my horse for me," said he. "But if you'll run in, chica, and throw a pot of coffee together while I attend to the caballo, I'll be a good deal obliged." Beside his marksmanship, the kid had another attribute for which he admired himself greatly. He was muy caballero, as the Mexicans express it, where the ladies were concerned. For them, he had always gentle words and consideration. He could not have spoken a harsh word to a woman. He might ruthlessly slay their husbands and brothers, but he could not have laid the weight of a finger in anger upon a woman. Wherefore, many of that interesting division of humanity who had come under the spell of his politeness, declared their disbelief in the story circulated about Mr. Kidd.
"One shouldn't believe everything one heard," they said.
When confronted by their indignant menfolk with proof of the caballero's deeds of infamy, they said maybe he had been driven to it, and that he knew how to treat a lady anyhow. Considering this extremely courteous idiosyncrasy of the kid and the pride he took in it, one can perceive that the solution of the problem that was presented to him by what he saw and heard from his hiding place in the pear that afternoon, at least as to one of the actors, must have been obscured by difficulties. And yet one could not think of the kid overlooking little matters of that kind. At the end of the short twilight, they gathered around a supper of frijoles, goat steaks, canned peaches, and coffee by the light of a lantern in the jacal. Afterward, the ancestor, his flock corralled, smoked a cigarette and became a mummy in a gray blanket. Tonya washed the few dishes while the kid dried them with the flour-sacking towel. Her eyes shone. She chatted volubly of the inconsequent happenings of her small world since the kid's last visit. It was as all his other homecomings had been. Then outside, Tonya swung in a grass hammock with her guitar and sang sad canciones de amor. "Do you love me just the same, old girl?" asked the kid, hunting for his cigarette papers.
"Always the same, little one," said Tanya, her dark eyes lingering upon him.
I must go over to Fink's, said the kid, rising, for some tobacco. I thought I had another sack in my coat. I'll be back in a quarter of an hour.
Hasten, said Tonya, and tell me, how long shall I call you my own this time? Will you be gone again tomorrow, leaving me to grieve? Or will you be longer with your Tonya?
Oh, I might stay 2 or 3 days this trip, said the kid, yawning. I've been on the dodge for a month, and I'd like to rest up. He was gone half an hour for his tobacco. When he returned, Tonya was still lying in the hammock. It's funny, said the kid, how I feel. I feel like there was somebody lying behind every bush and tree waiting to shoot me. I never had any molly grubs like them before. Maybe it's one of them perceptions. I've got half a notion to light out in the morning before day. The Guadalupe country is burning up about that old Dutchman I plugged down there.
You are not afraid. No one could make my brave little one fear.
Well, I haven't been usually regarded as a jackrabbit when it comes to scrapping. But I don't want a posse smoking me out when I'm in your jacal. Somebody might get hurt. That oughtn't to.
Remain with your Tonya. No one will find you here.
The kid looked keenly into the shadows up and down the arroyo and toward the dim lights of the Mexican village. I'll see how it looks later on, was his decision. At midnight, a horseman rode into the ranger's camp, blazing his way by noisy hellos to indicate a Pacific mission. Sandridge and one or two others turned out to investigate the row. The rider announced himself to be Domingo Sales from the Lone Wolf Crossing. He bore a letter for Señor Sandridge. Old Luisa, the lavandera, had persuaded him to bring it, he said, her son Gregorio being too ill of a fever to ride. Sandridge lighted the camp lantern and read the letter. These were its words.
Dear one, he has come. Hardly had you ridden away when he came out of the pear. When he first talked, he said he would stay 3 days or more. Then, as it grew later, he was like a wolf or a fox and walked about without rest, looking and listening. Soon, he said, he must leave before daylight, when it is dark and stillest. And then he seemed to suspect that I be not true to him. He looked at me so strange that I am frightened. I swear to him that I love him, his own Tonya. Last of all, he said, I must prove to him I am true. He thinks that even now men are waiting to kill him as he rides from my house. To escape, he says he will dress in my clothes, my red skirt and the blue waist I wear, and the brown mantilla over the head, and thus ride away. But before that, he says, that I must put on his clothes, his pantalones and camisa and hat, and ride away on his horse from the jacal as far as the big road beyond the crossing, and back again. This before he goes, so he can tell if I am true and if men are hidden to shoot him. It is a terrible thing. An hour before daybreak, this is to be. Come, my dear one, and kill this man, and take me for your Tonya. Do not try to take hold of him alive, but kill him quickly. Knowing all, you should do that. You must come long before the time, and hide yourself in the little shed near the jacal where the wagon and saddles are kept. It is dark in there. He will wear my red skirt and blue waist and brown mantilla. I send you 100 kisses. Come surely and shoot quickly and straight. Thine own, Tonya.
Sandridge quickly explained to his men the official part of the missive. The rangers protested against his going alone. I'll get him easy enough, said the lieutenant. The girl's got him trapped, and don't even think he'll get the drop on me.
Sandridge saddled his horse and rode to the Lone Wolf Crossing. He tied his big Don in a clump of brush on the arroyo, took his Winchester from its scabbard, and carefully approached the Perez Jacal. There was only the half of a high moon drifted over by ragged, milk-white gulf clouds. The wagon shed was an excellent place for an ambush, and the ranger got inside it safely. In the black shadow of the brush shelter in front of the Jacal, he could see a horse tied and hear him impatiently pawing the hard-trodden earth. He waited almost an hour before two figures came out of the Jacal. One, in man's clothes, quickly mounted the horse and galloped past the wagon shed toward the crossing and village. And then the other figure, in skirt, waist, a mantilla over its head, stepped out into the faint moonlight, gazing after the rider. Sandridge thought he would take his chance then before Tonya rode back. He fancied she might not care to see it. "Throw up your hands!" he ordered loudly, stepping out of the wagon shed with his Winchester at his shoulder. There was a quick turn of the figure, but no movement to obey. So the ranger pumped in the bullets. One, two, three, and then twice more. For you never could be too sure of bringing down the Cisco Kid. There was no danger of missing at 10 paces, even in that half moonlight. The old ancestor, asleep on his blanket, was awakened by the shots. Listening further, he heard a great cry from some man in mortal distress or anguish, and rose up grumbling at the disturbing ways of moderns. The tall, red ghost of a man burst into the Jacal, reaching one hand, shaking like a tule reed, for the lantern hanging on its nail. The other spread a letter on the table.
"Look at this, Perez," cried the man. "Who wrote it?"
Dios, it is Señor Sandridge," mumbled the old man, approaching.
"Pues, Señor.
That letter was written by El Chivato, as he is called, by the man of Tonya. They say he is a bad man. I do not know. While Tonya slept, he wrote the letter and sent it by this old hand of mine to Domingo Sales to be brought to you. Is there anything wrong in the letter? I am very old, and I did not know.
Valgame Dios,
it is a very foolish world, and there is nothing in the house to drink. Nothing to drink.
Just then, all that Sandridge could think of to do was to go outside and throw himself face downward in the dust by the side of his hummingbird, of whom not a feather fluttered. He was not a caballero by instinct, and he could not understand the niceties of revenge. A mile away, the rider who had ridden past the wagon shed struck up a harsh, untuneful song, the words of which began, "Don't you monkey with my Lulu girl, or I'll tell you what I'll do."
And now a poem from the May 9th, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine, "Sundown Walks to the Edge of the Story," by Joy Harjo. In the lands of forgotten memories, I hear a woman singing. A dog runs in circles, barking. Then children laugh as they run through. The sashes of one girl's dress are dragging on the ground from playing horse. In this story is a woman with a husband she adores. He is the color of warm brown earth, tall, with kind eyes that shine with love for her. When he loves,
It is with every part of his body. From his planted feet to his head, good with numbers. When she first lay down with him, their love made roots that dove into the ground, caressed the stones. These roots find water where water is needed. Those nights of early love, he spoke to her when she was sleeping. His words were the vision of an architect of dreams. He told her how he would treasure her, how they would walk through this life to the next with each other, no matter the tests and disappointments that befall a human on this earthly road. Those words blossomed into flowers, waters, and sunrises. She wears each day as a river pearl in a necklace. Though the pearls darken with age, they never let up their glow. Time is nothing in those lands. It has been years. They lay down together to sleep in their grown old bones, their weathered skins. She is a woman made of words. He is a man now impatient with words. They hold hands in the dark and fall asleep together. I find them as sundown walks to the edge of the story to wait for sunrise. I find them in a song about a woman weeping with joy, about a man whose love for her does not need words, but contains every color that love has ever worn. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.